The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
You can contact the show on @PatKennyNT on Twitter. You can text 53106 at a cost of 30 cents, and you can WhatsApp us 087-1400-106. As I said, the Minister, Stephen Donnelly, Minister for Health, will be joining us. He is here in studio. We will be talking to him about vaping and the proposals in respect of restricting disposable vapes. Before that, there is a plan being announced in respect of palliative care to ensure that people have equal access to palliative care across the country. Minister, good morning.
Good morning.
The issue with palliative care is what?
The issue with palliative care is bringing Ireland from being recognised as very good at this to really becoming a world leader. I think it goes to the heart of who we are. There's something deeply ingrained in us and in our nation around supporting people at, you know, through end of life care, and we are very good at palliative care. I had the great honour yesterday of launching the new strategy. We have a new strategy, and we put several million euro against it.
To achieve what? More beds?
To achieve a lot of things, but ultimately what we want is we want anyone who needs palliative care to be able to get it in their own home, in a community setting, in a hospice, or in a hospital where necessary.
And as we stand now, can they not?
In more and more places they can. The coverage is good. We have added about 50 extra hospice beds. There's another 15 being built, and we've 3 more hospices that we're getting started on. That'll give us very good national hospice coverage. We've invested over the last 4 years in the community teams. We've doubled the number of specialist nurses. And critically, what that's meant is more and more people can get access to palliative care from their own home.
But if more and more can get it, and more, as you say, need it, that means that there are those who currently can't. How significant is the deficit? How many people, particularly for end-of-life palliative care, are unable to access it currently?
Well, this is exactly what the plan that we launched yesterday was looking at it. So it recognised that we do a lot of it well, but that there are gaps. And we know this, be it in hospital care or access to GPs, or in this case, palliative care. What we want is we want everyone around the country to be able to get it.
But can you quantify those gaps?
I don't have the figures with me, but yes, the report yesterday looks at some of the regional inequalities, if you like. And what we're doing is we'll be investing more into those areas where there still is a bit of a struggle. But there's a lot of progress has been made by our healthcare workers over the last 4 years. We've all had, I'm sure, many of your listeners this morning will have had loved ones, friends, family use palliative care, and the difference that it makes when somebody is very sick is hard to quantify. I was out in St. Francis Hospice in Blanchardstown yesterday, meeting with some of the people there, meeting with our palliative care workers. So the plan that we launched yesterday, this is Palliative Care Week, and it's all about trying to encourage people to have what can be very difficult conversations, particularly with loved ones who are very sick, or for someone who might be very sick themselves, but to have these open conversations. And yesterday really was about backing patients, backing families, and backing our palliative care teams, and saying, you know, a lot of the time in healthcare, if we're talking about plans to deal with trolleys or waiting lists, we're trying to fix a problem. In fact, when it comes to palliative care, what we're saying is we as a nation we should be very proud of the work we have, but we want to go further. We want to really be one of the best in the world.
The ideological footing on which you do that, there are obviously different approaches to palliative care. There is at-home community-based care. There is acute care in hospitals where someone may have a palliative care team in what is otherwise an acute hospital. And there is hospice care. In the strategy as you have planned it, is there a particular focus that you are giving primacy to among those?
Yes, I'll give you 5 big themes from the strategy that come out of it for me. The first is around promoting these open discussions and shared decision making, a difficult thing for us to do, but so valuable when we can come together as family and do it. The second is around joined up care for the patient. So at the moment we have some good hospital care and hospice care and community care, but it's not always seamless. And particularly when someone is very sick, the family might be, you know, they might need a lot of support. We want it to be joined up care. Infrastructure has been called for, so more beds, more capital, better IT systems. We're poor on IT systems. more resources in the hospitals. So we've a phenomenal hospice movement, but we need more specialist beds and specialist units within the hospitals themselves.
Well, finally on the topic, fifth. Go on.
The fifth is really workforce planning. Make sure we have the specialist nurses, the specialist doctors in the years to come while we expand the service.
The capital allocation and the investment in resourcing within the existing supply, the amount of money that you're setting aside for that?
We're allocating 4 million to get things going, but there'll be a lot more money.
It's hardly a huge amount in the big scheme of things, is it?
To launch a strategy and get it going so they can start hiring in the new teams, it definitely allows them to move on it. But certainly over the last few years, we've increased the funding into palliative care by more than a half. So we've gone from about 100 million to about 155 million. We've given one-off funding of 20 million to the hospices, including over 2 million to Laura Lynn, which for me is one of the most incredible organisations in our country. And really importantly, what has happened with that is we've about 50 more beds and there's a lot more patients. We've a 30% increase in the number of patients being seen in the community. So as I said, it's not perfect. We have a ways to go, but it's something for us all to be immensely proud of. And if I could just use the opportunity to say to all of our healthcare workers working in palliative care, just thank you so much for what you do. It might be a very rewarding job, but it's a very difficult job as well. The care they provide is just incredible. So thank you to all of you who work in the area.
You have been in the news recently for a number of matters, prime amongst them. One is the vaping ban that you have brought in. The other is proposals in respect of social media and the urge to control social media for people under the age of 16. To the first of those, reports indicate that you want to move not only on disposable vapes, but on things like advertising of vapes, visibility in shops and flavours. Are we going to see anything happen on those?
Yes, we are. What we're doing is we're banning disposable vapes and we're banning flavoured vapes. And we're going to be bringing in restrictions to have plain packaging. And to get away from...
So the flavoured vapes is definite. The flavours are going to be gone.
Yes. So what we're doing is the new law will have the default of one flavour, which is tobacco flavour, but the Minister of Health of the day can expand that if they want to. We've taken a look around Europe. There are 6 countries that ban, restrict flavours. Most of them have just one flavour, which is tobacco. 1 or 2 have tobacco and menthol. So we're going to keep it very narrow. And really, the thread between the two issues you've just raised, vaping and online safety, is keeping young people safe. That's what this is all about.
Well, on that topic, we spoke the other day to oncologist Professor John Crown, and he was saying that in his view, vapes should be available only as effectively a prescribed medical intervention for those who are already smoking. Would you go that far?
It's an interesting suggestion, and it's either New Zealand or Australia have already done that. I can't remember which of them it is. I think for now, we're taking a pretty radical step already. Your listeners will recall that earlier on this year, we passed a law that banned the sale of vapes to children, to anyone under 18. And in about 2 weeks' time, there are more parts of that are coming into effect. So there'll be a ban on the sale of vapes at events for children, prohibition on advertising in cinemas for films for children, a ban on advertising on public transport or within 200 metres of a school. And really this new law is saying, look, the first law is fine, but we committed to going further. Disposable vapes has a big environmental effect as well. So we're doing it on environmental grounds as well. But it's children who are accessing the disposable
and
vapes.
And is it your concern that the vapes themselves are damaging to health or that they act as a gateway to smoking?
That they themselves are damaging. We have pretty solid evidence now that vaping for people under the age of 18 does cause very serious health concerns. The sort of peer-reviewed published evidence on the damage of vaping for adults is emerging. But I can tell you, when I talk to our respiratory clinicians in the hospitals who are treating people, they're saying to me, Stephen, there's no question. However, can I just say one thing that is important? They would also point out that whatever damage vaping is doing to adults is much, much less than the damage that smoking does, and therefore they'd prefer their patient not to smoke or vape. But if they had to choose, if vaping was a legitimate way to stop smoking, they would encourage that. Yeah.
On the topic of tobacco, you have used the tobacco analogy then in respect of social media. You have equated the kind of damage done by social media as not equal to but similar to the kind of damage that was done, and the response of social media companies as being in the kind of space that the tobacco companies were in the 60s and 70s. Your idea of preventing under 16s from having access to social media, surely the social media giants will just say, not a prayer.
This is very simple. And there is an analogy, I believe, to smoking, which is we now know categorically that there are vast and deep and sinister harms being done to young people through certain types of online activity, certain types of social media is just one, but on online platforms.
Now, do you mean predatory behavior by individuals, or do you mean the algorithms on which the social media is based are intrinsically damaging, regardless of whether there's somebody trying to do harm?
Both of those things. What kind of harms are we talking about? We all talk about online bullying, and we talk about some of the predatory issues you've just raised. But we also know there are links to children and self-harm and suicide ideation and suicide and violence against women and sexual violence against women and all sorts of really dark things. There is no question anymore about the link between certain types of
online
use.
But we also know that when the social media giants are asked to do this, the answer is either go away, it is free speech, or it is an exercise in tokenism that achieves nothing.
Yeah, and I'm sure the tobacco companies said exactly the same thing. And that's why it's incumbent upon government to act. And that's what we're doing. There's two really important new laws are in place now this year. One is at a European level, it's called the Digital Services Act. And then one is at an Irish level, it's called the Online Safety Act or Online Safety and Media Regulation Act. And actually, people around Europe now are looking at our local law, at our national law, and saying this is something that they might want to replicate. And what this does is it brings in massive fines. So fines as a percentage of global turnover for these companies. These companies have, you know, billions or God knows how much in global turnover. So we're talking about very, very serious amounts of money, but also there are criminal sanctions. So it allows us to begin going after senior executives in these companies and saying, I'm sorry,
but with great respect, Minister, we've seen the DPC, the Data
children.
Protection Commissioner,
you know it
for a long
time.
Indeed,
you're refusing
we've
to do it.
We've had situations where the DPC has, for many years, had a capacity to fine as a significant fraction of global turnover. And one of the challenges has been that any time they want to do it, it is legally extremely complex, and they get a huge amount of opposition. So the fact of a potential great penalty is not of much value if it can't be applied. So what guarantee is it that you will be able to actually use these punitive measures?
Well, the two laws are very new, the Digital Service Act and R1. There are several of the companies are under active investigation from Europe, and we're all watching that very carefully for exactly the question you've just posed. We need to know this is effective. The laws are in place this year, and our own online binding code, we believe, will come into force. We're hoping in October. So we're talking about just a few short weeks. But from a public health perspective, we're going further. So I fully support the work, and Catherine Martin deserves great credit for her work on the Online Safety Act. We have a formidable Online Safety Commission team. They have left the social media companies and online platforms in no doubt as to how deadly serious the Irish government is about this. But we are going further in healthcare. In healthcare, I'm saying this is a public health crisis. Children are being damaged in multiple ways, and we have an obligation to make sure parents know about it, to make sure parents have the tools that they need. Parents cannot be expected to do this on their own. Children cannot be expected to do this
on their own. Have you the evidence and the medical evidence for that, or is that political hyperbole?
Oh, we have evidence. We have evidence from Europe. We have evidence from our own researchers. We have evidence from the US Surgeon General. I've put together an expert group, and their first meeting is this week. We have Professor Debbie Ging on it from DCU. She's published research on the kind of damage being done. Our Online Safety Commissioner, Niamh Hodnett, is on in an observer capacity. We have Gillian Van Turnhout chairing it. We have secondary school, primary school presence. We have young people on it. There's no question anymore about the damage that's being done. And when I talk to parents about this a lot. And when we get into it, and when you tell them the extent of the damage and show them the kind of things that they're 10-year-old boy or 12-year-old girl or 14-year-old boy is being targeted with, they get very, very concerned. So my view is pretty simple, right? Parents will always do right by their kids, but they need help with this one. Young people need help. And I'm saying we are fundamentally changing the conversation with the online platforms. We're done with saying, would you mind doing the right thing?
And you think they'll come to heel?
Well, if you start fining people based on global turnover and you start bringing criminal charges against senior executives and companies, that's what worked against the tobacco companies, and I think it can work here.
The one question, of course, in that is what impact does that have on FDI? Because if you start to criminally sanction the executives of large FDI investors who run their EMEA operations out of Dublin, I'm sure it will give pause for thought for a lot of the companies on whose corporation tax we depend.
No, I don't think so at all. I think any serious company would say we want our product to be safe. You know, and we have a very significant presence here in terms of digital. They're very responsible. They will want to do the right thing. Many of them already are. But the reality is there is a number of companies. They know they're damaging children. They've done very little about it. They've paid lip service to it. And we've had enough. And so we are changing the conversation to say, you must make your product safe for our children.
Okay. On the topic of FDI, how much work is the IDA going to have to do to explain to potential FDI investors what happened with the Apple tax?
Well, not much, I don't think.
Think it's reputationally damaging?
I don't think it's reputationally damaging. And I'll tell you why. Because what FDI want, if you're looking at investing in Europe and you're looking at creating a lot of jobs in Ireland, like Apple...
Consistency, predictability and no sweetheart deals. And what they've discovered is inconsistency, unpredictability and a sweetheart deal.
I don't think that's correct. That's certainly not how I would see it. What we have is an opinion given by the Revenue Commissioners in 1991 and 2007. Historic opinions. The Revenue Commissioners did nothing wrong. They gave an opinion based on the law. And what FDI will see in Ireland is a very stable country, a very clear, competitive country. And they will have seen the Irish government, when questions were raised and when the Commission potentially was going to start meddling in Ireland's tax structures, which is none of their business, they will have seen the Irish state stand up and say, we are standing over.
So best of both worlds, no reputational damage and 13 billion we weren't expecting.
Well, potentially. I don't think there is reputational damage. Like these cases have been going on now for a number of years. And what are we seeing? We're seeing ongoing investment. We're seeing a big surge in corporate taxes. So the money that I very gratefully get from government to allocate for palliative care or to take on, you know, vaping and these things, you know, a lot of that is coming from these companies.
Well, this, of course, begs the question, what are we going to do with the money?
Well, that is a big question. That's a $14 billion question, isn't it? I'm sure lots of us in the public and in the media and in the Oireachtas and in government have ideas about that.
And what are yours?
There are a lot of options. We can look at national debt. We can look at long-term infrastructure funds that were set up in the last 2 years.
And what's
years.
Your preference?
Well, I'll be giving my preferences privately. Probably not good. I mean, obviously, as Minister for Health, I would have a view.
True, but it's unlikely they're going to cut a cheque of 13 billion to you as minister.
I would say
is it your view that it should be something that is used to pay down national debt? Is it your view that it should be one-off capital investment? Should it be used as general exchequer? Should it be used as a one-time boon into the coming election?
I think that's something for our two finance ministers, for Jack Chambers and Pascal Donoghue, to reflect on. I think they have a number of very good options. And it wouldn't surprise me if it ends up being, you know, a combination of things that you've just suggested.
Lastly, on the topic of the coming election, has your constituency colleague warned you to get the posters ready for November?
You know, he's not returning my texts on this on this matter. Look, who knows? Who knows? All I can tell you is that both publicly and privately, the three party leaders are saying March. That's what they're saying. So let's see.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.